go on to the next case, Kathleen Bouchard versus the commissioner. Mr. Daly?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel for the defendant. My name is Frederick Daly, and I represent the plaintiff, Kathleen Bouchard. In denying this disability claim, the administrative law judge found that he rejected the opinion of the treating doctor, who was a specialist in pulmonary medicine, Dr. Alan Leff. In doing so, normally a treating doctor's opinion is given controlling weight under the regulations at 404.15.27. Here, in order to reject a treating doctor, the administrative law judge must find that there's substantial evidence in the record that supports a contrary opinion. It's our position that, as a matter of law, the state agency doctor's opinions, the non-examining, non-treating, non-specialist opinions from 1992, cannot be considered substantial. This court's decision in Allen versus Weinberger, along with the Social Security rulings at 96-6P, require that the state agency doctor, in deciding whether what weight should be given to such an opinion, you must consider two things. Did the doctor review the entire file? And secondly, it depends also upon the degree to which they support their opinion. Here, there's basically no discussion in supporting either opinion.
Could I ask you a question, Mr. Daly? When we have the 95 hearing, the second one, is the ALJ looking at her condition in 95 or in 92?
The ALJ was looking at her condition in 92.
But he can look at this other evidence, more reports from physicians which might have been generated after 92.
Well, we had a lengthy discussion at the hearing about that. The appeals counsel vacated the decision. It was de novo. The ALJ considered that I'm just going to consider the mental impairment, and you're going to have to give me new and material evidence to convince me to change my mind on the RFC. That was his position.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to convince him in my closing memorandum as well as at the hearing. He then, in his decision, did discuss some of the evidence. I believe he discussed it more in terms of whether that's new and material evidence that would get him to change his mind, because he didn't do what normally would be done in a case in 1995, and that would be either refer the claimant to a consultative doctor to get an updated report, and or have a medical expert come to the hearing, which is very normal in a pulmonary case. So I believe that he did not consider it vacated, and he did not consider that he had to make a de novo opinion. But the appeals counsel clearly vacated the decision. Dr. Leff, at page 523 of the record, gave an opinion that based on those spirometry testing, which there's like 50 of them in the record, and I think 33 of them after the 1992 opinions of the state agency doctors. He gave an opinion that the FEV1 and FVC have to be considered along with the emphysema, the chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and the fact that she had lungs that were inflated to 140% of normal, and that her ear was trapped. That's a medical opinion by a specialist. There's no contrary opinion in the record. The ALJ had ample opportunity to have, he could give an interrogatory to a medical expert, he could have a supplemental hearing, he could have had a medical expert at the hearing. There's no reason why that opinion should not be given controlling weight.
So you're basically saying that that the specialist has explained the FE, whatever these numbers are, FEV1 and FVC numbers in a way that's more sophisticated than the simple ratios would suggest.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's my opinion that our position that even the doctor that had originally seen the plaintiff, Dr. Cohen, hadn't seen her since May of 1991. He didn't come up with a reason why she was having the problems as bad as she was. But, you know, 5 years had gone by from the time that he saw her to the time of the ALJ's decision. And, you know, his opinion just doesn't seem like it could be substantial evidence.
But why does he keep saying that she's completely disabled? I mean, one of the things the ALJ disbelieves is her ability to conduct, you know, to do things during the day, if you will, her daily activities, whether her daily activity level would be suggestive of the ability to work. And the ALJ looks at other evidence and says, you know, maybe Dr. Leff is just too much of her advocate, and he's off there saying she's totally disabled, in the meantime she's doing all this stuff.
Well, maybe if he had a medical expert at the hearing who disagreed with Dr. Leff and gave a detailed reasoned opinion why he disagreed with it, the ALJ would have the opportunity to do that. But on this record, that seems to be an end run around Dr. Leff without coming in with a medical opinion. The activities, if you look at the RFC of Dr. Leff in 1992 and in 1994-1995, the plaintiff's condition improved somewhat under the treatment with him. And ultimately, Dr. Leff was saying, there, you know, she could stand up to 2 hours a day, and she would be able to sit as much as she wants. But the problem you're going to have is if you're asking whether she can go in and do work day in and day out, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week and 40 hours, it's just not going to happen without
Dr.
having
exacerbation. I'm sorry. Did Dr. Leff ever explain what he meant by 2 months? That she couldn't work? Was he sort of saying a day here and a day there during the year was going to add up ultimately to the equivalent of 2 months, or was he saying there were chunks of time she was going to have to take off from work?
No, it was my understanding that it would accumulate over a year, because she had testified that she was very susceptible to colds and things, you know, getting diseases that she never used to get, flus and colds frequently, more than one would normally expect from a healthy person, and that made it so that she was very fatigued. She testified, I think she said 3 to 4 days a month she'd have difficulty getting her child dressed. So it wouldn't be an everyday thing, but under the rulings, if you can't do your past work, to be considered to do any other work as light work or any of the jobs mentioned by the VE, sedentary work, you have to be there every day. And it can't be part-time work, and you can't take unscheduled breaks. And predominantly what the claimant was saying, Ms. Bouchard, and the doctor, was that she's going to have times during the day, some days are worse than others, but cumulatively over a year, you cannot expect her to be there every day, and she may miss up to 2 months a year.
Okay.
As far as making a credibility finding, the administrative law judge finds that she's, you know, partially credible, and he takes her to the plaintiff's testimony to find that she's no longer disabled. And that she was never disabled for physical reasons. And I think under the Zabluski case from this court and the rulings at 96-7P, there has to be the accurate logical bridge from the testimony to the findings, and that's not here. For instance, the ALJ found that she was able to take care of her young child, but she made it clear at the hearing she had a full-time housekeeper and a babysitter, and her mother and sister came and helped. So it's misconstruing the testimony against her and is an inaccurate recitation of her testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Thorson?
May it please the Court, I'm Mary Thorson for the Commissioner of Social Security. At issue is whether the ALJ's decision that Ms. Bouchard was only disabled for a closed period is supported by substantial evidence. The ALJ found Ms. Bouchard was not disabled prior to May of 1993, when he determined that a mental impairment further limited her to the extent that she couldn't work. He also found that she was not disabled after November 1995, when her hearing testimony indicated that she had improved sufficiently to allow her to return to work.
But that one bothers me, particularly the second one, because to rely on evidence that's so stale from the medical point of view of these 1991 and 1992 determinations about her condition in 1995, and utterly to disregard the only doctor who has seen her as of a current time, is very troubling. It seems to me like it'd be going to, you know, fill a prescription that some doctor gave you 4 years ago on the assumption that that might still be an appropriate prescription for you, and most of us wouldn't be that foolish. You'd go back and check. And I see a total dearth of evidence here in the record as to the post-1995 period. The only doctor to say anything is Dr. Leff, and he's explained why it is that these lung reading values don't tell you about her air exchange. Actually, you know, if the air is sitting there dead in your lungs, as he explains, you're not getting any oxygen, and you don't breathe just for the fun of it. You breathe to get the oxygen.
Well, I have a couple of responses to that, Your Honor. First off, as far as the earlier reports, Ms. Bouchard testified at the supplemental hearing that her respiratory impairment was essentially unchanged from when she testified back in, I believe it was 1992 or 93.
But is she a doctor?
No, she's not a doctor.
We have Dr. Leff.
We have Dr. Leff, certainly.
What the level of her impairment is.
In addition to her testimony that her impairment didn't change significantly, she also added that she'd stopped taking a steroid medication.
Right. But you know what? My problem with that is, suppose a doctor is managing your care, and he decides, for whatever reason, to take you off medication A, which we will define as a rather dangerous medication with very serious long-term effects. And instead, he puts you on medications B, C, and D for a while, which is what Dr. Leff did. Hard for me to draw much of an inference that the doctor has chosen to substitute a cocktail of medications for an earlier medication that you're not sick anymore. Prednisone is powerful stuff. It makes you lose all your hair. It makes you, you know, jittery. It affects your immune system profoundly. The doctor may have thought, let's try these other medications.
Well, certainly that's a consideration, Your Honor. First off, though, I'm not sure that Dr. Leff actually substituted a number of medications for prednisone.
Well, he kept her on these. He kept taking three medications.
Certainly.
And prednisone is a dangerous substance.
Correct. But apparently, as we pointed out in the commissioner's brief, Dr. Leff felt that despite the fact that there were some dangers that accompanied prednisone usage, he nonetheless felt that her condition was so severe early on that he would go ahead and administer it anyway.
But it accumulates over time, too.
It certainly
does. So the fact
does.
That he risks it for a while doesn't mean that he's going to risk it forever. I'm just saying it's a medical judgment. And to say, oh, she's not taking prednisone anymore, it seems to me doesn't, I don't know how, without being a doctor, especially the ALJ, can draw any inference from that fact about the quality of her improvement.
Well, Your Honor, the ALJ considered a host of other factors when he looked at Ms. Bouchard's respiratory condition. He suggested that her respiratory condition improved, but that finding wasn't integral to his finding that she was no longer disabled in November 1995, because the record really showed her respiratory impairment was fairly stable, and in fact his notes reflect that over the years that her respiratory condition was stable.
But if it's stable, didn't Dr. Left say that it was stable at a rather low functioning level? I mean, it could be on a scale of 1 to 100, it could be stable at a 10, a 50, or an 85.
Certainly. This court held in Powers, however, that was certainly one valid consideration for the agency to consider when evaluating a physician's report. And really,
does he tell you which level of stable he means?
Dr. Leff provides a number of explanations
for
his various opinions.
The ALJ,
I don't believe he went into significant detail analyzing that. But at bottom, Dr. Leff's opinions were really unsupported here. He tried to explain away the very mild objective test results, and his records contain virtually no findings of a disabling respiratory impairment. So between those two...
What do you mean, explain away? You don't think that air exchange in the lungs is a thing that a pulmonologist would take into account?
I absolutely do, but Dr. Leff doesn't explain why Ms. Bouchard's hyperinflation of her lungs is so significantly different from any other emphysema patient that the agency's regulations and criteria don't apply to her. And that's essentially what he's saying. The objective tests that we always look at to evaluate severity of respiratory impairments don't apply to my patient, and here's why. And he also justified it based on all the telephone calls, which we pointed out in our brief, there were only 3 reports in 5 years of evaluating Ms. Bouchard after a telephone call, and I don't believe counsel refuted that in his reply brief. So there's an awful lot about Dr. Leff's reports that simply don't hold up.
But you know, another thing the ALJ relied on that bothered me quite a bit was the number of visits to the emergency room she either did or didn't make. Because the truth is, in today's world of insurance controls, people can't just go to emergency rooms. They are strongly discouraged from doing so because they won't get reimbursed by their insurance companies if it's not a drastic enough situation. I suppose if somebody shot you down in the street, maybe the ER wouldn't say, you know, did you call your insurance company first? But I don't see where anyone draws an inference about whether she's well or not by the number of ER visits.
Well, Your Honor, I think with a respiratory impairment where an individual feels like they can't breathe, I suspect that their insurance isn't really foremost in their mind when they're having significant distress, in addition to which it appears that Ms. Bouchard probably had the resources, if her insurance were to deny coverage for emergency room visits, that wouldn't be a significant barrier for her.
Thousands of dollars?
Most people take that into account. Certainly. But once again, I think an individual who feels like they cannot breathe is certainly not thinking about the cost of getting relief.
So the commissioner thinks only people who can't breathe are
disabled? Absolutely not, Your Honor. I'm saying that individuals with respiratory impairments whose treatment is very, very routine, as Ms. Bouchard's was, are not necessarily disabled, as Dr. Leff has suggested over and over and over, most of the time in letters to counsel rather than in his treatment notes, which, as we pointed out, are virtually devoid of objective medical signs that Ms. Bouchard was ever in any respiratory distress when he saw her, which led the ALJ to conclude that his opinions were based on Ms. Bouchard's telephone reports to him and virtually nothing more. There's ample evidence in the record. The reviewing physicians, for example, reviewed the same pulmonary function tests that showed the hyperinflation that Dr. Leff refers to, and nonetheless felt she could do light work.
Based on this old evidence, nobody looked at anything in 95.
Well, the old evidence is what Dr. Leff cites to in 1995 for the chronic hyperinflation of 140% of normal. So Dr. Leff is relying on the 1991 pulmonary function test to justify his explanation that no, your usual medical criteria don't apply to my patient. You can't apply these criteria to my patient because I say she's disabled, even though my clinical records document virtually no findings of distress, and her pulmonary function tests really look pretty good compared to those you would expect of a disabling respiratory impairment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Daly? Less than a minute.
Dr. Leff is the only pulmonary specialist who gave an opinion in the record. The other doctors may have had some hyperinflation evidence to look at, but they didn't mention it. They could have maybe not noticed it, maybe not qualified to make that type of analysis. Certainly the state agency, non-treating, non-examining doctors didn't appear to be qualified. But Dr. Leff was the only pulmonary doctor. If you look at the RFC he gives, it really isn't an impression of bending over backwards for some reason why he would do that. I don't know. There's not an impression of bending over backwards because he's really got her almost at sedentary work, except that she would not be able to do it repeatedly on a consistent basis. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much. The case will be taken under advisement.